Indeed, reality.
Reality.
It's the same option.
Yeah, you're not supposed to notice. I haven't unpacked.
That's okay.
Still a thing.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome back.
Mm-hmm. What happened
here? We're going to jump right in. Last week we spent a bit of time talking about the migration of Shevet Dan to from their assigned tribal location on the east, sorry, on the west, all the way up north into the area of the Bashan. And the two anchors of the story that we've been studying, which is the idol of Micha and the idolatry that he creates, and ultimately the migration of Shevet Dan as they come through the house of Micha and steal the idol, take it up north, and create their own sort of temple of Avodah Zarah up in the north in the area of Dan. And the story is very nonchalantly told to us in terms of their migration, in terms of the settlement, in terms of the conquest of the area of the Bashan. And oh, they took Micha's pestle, they took his idols, they took the Levi, they went up north, settled there, set this Levi up as the Kohen Gadol for the tribe of Dan. And if you look at the end of the story, end of Perek Yud Chet, the very end of Perek Yud Chet, so Lamed Lamed Aleph
3:17.
Very end of the story concludes Ve'akimu lehem b'nei Dan et ha'paso. B'nei Dan set this idol up there in the area of Shevet Dan. Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe hu v'nav ayu cho'anim l'shevet adani ad yom g'lot ha'aretz. And this individual, Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe, whom we spoke about at length, connection to Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe's grandson possibly, he and his sons after him were Kohanim in this house of Avodah Zarah to Shevet Dan all the years until ultimately Shevet Dan went into exile together with the northern tribes, which is a good several hundred years later. Vayasimu lahem et pesel micha asher asa. They put pesel micha there in the in Shevet Dan. And there it stood for all the years that the Mishkan stood in Shiloh. And that's the way the story concludes, with this kind of picture of the Mishkan in Shiloh and this Pesel Micha up in Shevet Dan, and that's the end of the story. Now, it's all the background and all the information about Micha and the money and the silver and the house of Avodah Zarah and the hotel and Har Ephraim and the Levi traveling through and Shevet Dan conquering, looking for a place to conquer and conquering Laish and migrating up into the north and taking the stopping of the bed and breakfast and taking Micha's idol with him and stealing the coin. All of this concludes with one statement. Sitting up there in the north, in Shevet Dan north, is the idol of Micha and their Beit Avodah Zarah all the years that the Mishkan stood in Shiloh. That's where the story concludes, and it leaves us with this kind of gaping hole. Suddenly and out of nowhere, the text throws us into the Mishkan in Shiloh. Beit Elokim b'Shiloh. When was the last time the reference to the Mishkan in Shiloh appears in Tanakh?
Chana.
Chana's later. We haven't had Chana yet. Chana's beginning of Sefer Shmuel.
Oh.
I didn't know if everything was in order or not.
Everything is absolutely in order. Nevi'im, Yishonim, Yeshua, Shoftim, Shmuel. Yeshua is about 20 years of history. Shoftim is about 370.
Would it be insane for Yeshua then? Right.
The last time the Mishkan is mentioned in Tanakh,
say Yaakov,
no, not quite that far back. But the last time Mishkan is mentioned in Shiloh explicitly Well, there's an explicit reference and there's an implicit reference. The explicit reference is in Yehoshua Perek Yudchet, which is where the Mishkan is put in Shiloh in the first place. Beginning of Perek Yudchet, Vayikalu kol adat bnei Yisrael Shiloh. Don't worry about flipping the pages. It's one verse. Vayikalu kol adat bnei Yisrael Shiloh. All of Israel gathered in Shiloh. Vayashkinu sham et Ol Moed. There they placed the Ol Moed, but the reference, the word Vayashkinu comes Shin Yukaf Nun, comes the word Shchinu or Mishkan. There they put the Ol Moed. Ve'aretz nichbashalif nehem, and then they began the conquest of the land. In other words, Perek Yudchet is the process of the conquering of the land, and Yehoshua, 300, unclear when the story of Pesach Micha took place, but in terms of the historical context of Sefer Shoftim, Yehoshua is the beginning and the end of Shoftim is 370 years later. So whether this, we're going to come to in a moment, this, the chronological reference of our story. But certainly, the Mishkan is put in Shiloh in Perek Yudchet of Sefer Yehoshua. We don't find reference to the Mishkan again until our Pasuk. And that really is a mystery. All of Sefer Yehoshoftim covers the span of 360. Well, they say that the Mishkan stood in Shiloh for 369 years. Mm-hmm. The Mishkan is destroyed at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. So let's assume for the moment we're 40 years before the end of Shoftim. Shimshon is 40 years before, maybe give or take. So, but certainly more than 300 years. Yiftach is 300 years from Yitzhak Mitzrayim. So certainly more than 300 years from that point in terms of text. And in those 300 years, the Mishkan has been mentioned how many times?
Just zero.
Zero. In those middle years. That's really a remarkable mystery. A remarkable, remarkable mystery. The only hint to it, possibly, is in Shoftim Perek Bet, there's a reference to the Malach who comes to them from Gilgal and criticizes the people for their backsliding into the world of Avodah Zarah, and there's a reference to the Malach coming to them in a city called Bochim, because they're all crying. They name the city Bochim because they're all crying. Maybe, don't worry about it, I'm not flipping. Maybe that could be a reference to the Malach or a Navi comes to them, he's talking to them, in all likelihood, Chazal said it's Pinchas, that might be taking place in Shiloh. But even then, it's not recorded. So the fact that the story at the end of the episode takes us into a picture of Pesach Micha up in Shevet Dan, while the Mishkan is sitting in Shiloh, begs the question of where is Shiloh in all of this? How did suddenly Shiloh enter into the conversation? That's the first question that's one of the questions I want to deal with today. The other question I want to address today, which we're going to start from and then go backwards, is the phrase that we've mentioned many times is sort of the key phrase that links the story of Pesach Micha, which we've been studying now, the next story, which is Pilegesh Begiva. These two stories that appear at the end of Sefer Shoftim, and they're connected by a single phrase. That phrase being, no king of Israel in those days, every man did what was right in his own eyes. It's a phrase that appears twice the story of Pesach Micha, twice in the story of Pilegesh Begiva, brackets the story at the beginning and at the end, and in the middle. If you, on your source pages, if you flip them over, you have the chart of those, depending which side you're on, but if you flip over to the side of the other side, right, you'll find that in the middle, you have the all four references to this phrase. Mm-hmm. The beginning of Pesach Micha is the full version of the phrase by Mimahem Ein Melech B'Israel Ishi Yeshar Be'Nav Yaseh Perek Yud Zayin. Then, in the middle of the story of Shevet Dan, beginning of Perek Yud Chet, you have the short version of the phrase by Amimahem Ein Melech BeYisrael. There's no, in those days, there's no king of Israel, and Shevet Dan was going to look for their migration for their land. Then, at the beginning of Perek Yud Tet, the next story, Pelegish Begiva. There's no king of Israel in those days. Suddenly a story about a Levi in Har Ephraim, which is not the same Levi and not the same story, but there's a Levi in Har Ephraim which connects the two stories. And then at the end of Perek Chaf Aleph, which is the very last verse of Sefer Shoftim, you also have it on your page. An exact repeat of the pasuk from Perek Zion with which the stories began. I think I mentioned to you once before that the way I see those four phrases is that there's a, it's one phrase. Ein melech b'Yisrael ish yeshar b'nav yaseh. No king of Israel, each man did what is right in his own eyes. It's one phrase. The beginning and the end, you have the full version of it. In the middle, you have a kind of shorthand version of it. Just the phrase, B'imimahem en melech b'Yisrael, dot, 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 fill in the rest. And so that, and that phrase, by virtue of the fact that it connects these two stories, begs two questions. Number one, what is the reference to melech? How did melech enter into the conversation? There's no melech in Sefer Shoftim to speak of. It's a book about Shoftim, not about kings. And number two, what is the meaning of the phrase Ish HaYashar Be'Nav Yaseh? Anarchy, free-for-all, lawlessness. What's the connection between Ish HaYashar Be'Nav Yaseh? Is it just a general phrase, or does it have significant meaning? What is the phrase itself? So what I'm going to suggest is we start from this. I promised you that Bezrat Hashem this week we would address the question of this phrase and what it means, at least half of it. And then from there I think we'll be able to work our way back into the story of Pesel Micha. So let's start with the first part of it. Ein Melech B'Yisrael. No king of Israel. What is the significance of suggesting that there is no king of Israel? First of all, what's the problem with that phrase?
Would you think there was a king of Israel when you've always had a Nabi?
Right. Why would you think there's a king of Israel when you always had a Shofet? How did the word Melech enter into the lexicon of Sefer Shoftim? There's only one reference to the word Melech. Welcome back.
It has
been. It's wonderful. How does the word Melech enter into the lexicon of Israel? Do you have a Tanakh? Grab a source page, grab a Tanakh. I think they're taken.
They're all taken.
We're fine. How does the word Melech enter into the lexicon of Sefer Shoftim? So, if you take a look at the Mefarshim on the source page, I've shared with you two very different explanations of the phrase that have significant ramifications for our understanding of the story. Let's start with the Radak. Ish HaYashar Be'Nav Yaseh, each man did what is right in his own eyes, says the Radak. Amar Zeh, why does the, do you have it in the bottom of the source page? Radak, source number 7. Sorry, I gave away my last source page. So. Did I? That doesn't make any sense. Where's the hole-punched version? One of those versions have a three holes punched in it?
No,
I have the hole-punched version. But where's, does it, one of those versions that you have a hole punched on it?
No.
There it is. Okay, source number 7. Ish HaYashar Be'Nav Yaseh. Amar zeh, says Radak, this phrase is referenced here. Lefi shasam micha ha-pesel. Why is it that no man, each one did what is right in their own eyes, meaning that there's no control, there's no oversight, there's no nobody stopping them? What's the significance here? Because we're talking about the creation of Micha's idol. Idol, temple, bed and breakfast, Avodazara, fill in the blank. There was nobody to stop them. Why was there nobody to stop them? Ki ein melech v'shofet bayamim mahen. Notice what the Radak does. There is no melech or shofet in those days. He adds the phrase shofet. What is he driving at?
There's
no leadership.
No leadership, correct. Radak sees the word melech as synonymous with the word leadership. Melech, shofet, essentially all boil down to the same thing, which is a leadership and therefore control, limits on society, and certainly limits in terms of law. And when you're dealing with Israel, you're dealing with the world of Avodah Zarah, had there been a melech or a shofet, like any of the shoftim that we have studied, Otniel ben Knaz, Eil ben Gera, Devorah, Barak, Shimshon, Yiftach, I'll take a Yiftach, anybody. Anybody could have stopped Micha from creating such an idol. The fact that we have now entered into a post-melech / shofet era means that we are in free fall.
It's post-shofet pre-melech.
We're in this window of post-leadership, post-shofet / melech, any kind of leadership role. We are in the end of Sefer Shoftim. We are in a transitional phase between the world of the Shoftim, in which at some point in time, when there were people were backsliding into Avodah Zarah, somebody arose to kind of put limits on their experience of on their idolatry. We're not yet into the world of Melech, but we're in this no man's land of no king, no shofet, no leadership. Ish yeshar ben aviasa. Everybody was going about doing their own thing.
But that contradicts what you, I mean, one of the Mefarshim that said that this all happened pre.
So go back, we're going to come back to that in a second, but if you remember, I said that there's a major dispute amongst the Mefarshim as to when this story took place.
Right.
So you're right, it doesn't contradict anything other than there's a difference of opinion here. There's a profound difference of opinion as to when the story took place.
Person is Moshe's grandson. I mean,
well, then you'd have to assume that Moshe's grandson is 300 and plus years old. That is true.
Okay.
That is true.
The
correct.
We've had old people in
Tanakh. Yeah, it is all possible. But you are correct. There is an assumption here that the story of Pesach Micha is chronologically in its sequence. That's exactly the assumption with which the Radak is beginning.
So
start with the assumption that the stories are sequential, mm-hmm. and therefore Pesel Micha is taking place post-Shimshon, before Shmuel. Mm-hmm. In a post-Shimshon world, we are at a time of Bimimahem Ein Melech B'Yisrael. What do you mean Ein Melech? We're talking about Shoftim. Says the Radak, translate the word Shofet, translate the word melech as leadership of any kind. Melech, shofet, it's all interchangeable. There isn't really a significant difference between a melech and shofet in terms of the job description. There may be some nuanced distinctions when we begin Sefer Shmuel. We'll talk about what the real distinctions are between a shofet and a melech. But for all intents and purposes, at this point, they're synonymous. Somebody needs to be in control, and we are in a post Shofet leadership world, says the Radak.
It's a free for all. It's chaos.
It's a free for all and a free fall. Correct.
Free fall.
Anarchy.
Spiraling.
Right? We've reached a point where, Avodah Zarah wise, we're just all over the place. The Rabag has a different take on the story. And he says the following, a remarkable phrase. Ein melech b'Yisrael. V'sipur zeh ki ulai ze haya siba lehasot ze hapesa. Why do I need to mention that there's no king of Israel? Because clearly, as an introduction to the story of the creation of the idol of Micha, some connection between the absence of a king and the idol and the creation of the idolatry is significant. This is telling me that this was post the only king who could have prevented them from doing so, Im Hu Chai, had he still been alive. And who is the only king, who is the king who could have stopped them from making this idol? Yehoshua. Yehoshua. And since we are now in the time frame of Menashe ben Gershom ben Moshe, we're in the time frame of Moshe's grandson, where two generations later, Yehoshua is gone, beginning of Sefer Shoftim. Yehoshua is out of the picture. Therefore, there was nobody to stop them because Ein Melech b'Yisrael. Yeshua is gone. There's no king. Lefi Mashech Shov sheizhir Yisrael al zeh kedei levaer avadat gililim. My understanding of this phrase is that this was to tell me, to warn them to remove the idolatry. Ki gam Eli sheya nichbad mikol asher lefanav mi'ashoftim lo bi'aru bi'amav ha'ba'alim v'ashtarot ad shebashmuel hu bi'aram. So there was no king, there was no shofet who was able to remove idolatry from the land completely. Even Eli was unable to remove the idolatry as significant and as powerful and as important as he was. The first person to really succeed in removing the idolatry from the land, north to south, east to west, is Shmuel, says the Rabbag, as it says in Sefer Shmuel. V'lezeh arach alav pesa micha ad mot Eli. And that's why Pesach Micha was able to survive until the end of the story of Eli, the end of Shiloh, as it says at the end of the Parsha, that this idol stood all the way until the end of the Mishkan Shiloh until the end of the time frame of Mishkan Shiloh. So says the Rabbag, essentially, that the phrase En Melech Bisrael means that there was no king able to stop them because we are post the only king who could have done so, which is Yehoshua.
But you know, it's interesting because that echoes that thing that since there was no king, they had to have, therefore they had to make an idol, sort of reminds you of, you know, the golden calf. You know, Moses goes up and they think he's gone, so they need something to...
Yeah,
I don't know.
I think you're giving them far too much credit. You're assuming that they're making this idol because they want a replacement for a Navi. First of all, it's not a Navi, it's a king. I'm talking about a king, not a Navi. Second of all, I don't think that they Micha's Pesel and his mother's oath and the 900 talents of silver and the Trefim and the I don't see this as a kind of you'll forgive me, whitewashed idolatry that you have in the assumption. Let's take one step back. What you're assuming is that when the people made the golden calf, they really weren't worshipping idols. They really weren't being Ovid of Odazah. They were really looking to replace Moshe Rabbeinu, which is an interpretation of the story. It's not Rashi's, but it's others. Yeah. Rashi says it was Ovid Azarah, pshutu kimashmo, real pagan idolatry. They just stooped back to their roots. But others do suggest what you are suggesting with regards to the golden calf, Kuzari most famously, that they were looking to replace Moshe, they were looking for an intermediary, they didn't have a Navi, they thought this could replace the Navi. Very nice, sort of kind of whitewashes it a little bit. I'm not sure I would give this generation of Pesach Micha that much credit. They don't seem to me like they're looking to replace the Navi. They look to me like they just, that's the world in which they operate, which is the world of Avodah Zarah. And especially in the heels of the end of Sefer Shoftim, where every generation is worshipping idols. The story here is about idolatry, not about intermediaries. Mm-hmm. So I have two suggestions as to what the phrase Melech, Ein Melech Bisrael means. Radak, who says that the story is late, chronologically late, and therefore Melech is synonymous with leadership in some way, Melech or Shofet, and that we're into this period of anarchy. And the Habakkuk says, well, the story is really very early. In fact, it's so early that it's in the immediate aftermath of the death of Yeshua, and the Navi is saying, after the death of Yeshua, Ein Melech b'Yisrael. So we ended up with Shoftim, but the Shoftim are a poor imitation of what a Melech like Yehoshua was about. The only problem with that interpretation, again, is that Yehoshua, although Chazal suggests that both Moshe and Yehoshua, the only suggestion between Yehoshua although Chazal connect the notion of Moshe and Yehoshua to Melech, and suggest that Moshe was a Melech and that Yehoshua was a Melech, at no point, Moshe already, this may be a phrase, Vehi Bishu and Melech, but at no point is Yehoshua ever described as a Melech. So in and of itself, that is a little bit of a problem for us. There's another possibility. What's the third possibility? What does the phrase Ein Melech Yisrael mean?
God, that
is
referring to the
Ribbono Shel Olam? No. That far wouldn't go. Because it's the Navi speaking. Ein Melech Yisrael. It's the Navi speaking. It's not the people speaking. It's the Navi speaking. Therefore, this could happen because Ein Melech Yisrael. It's another possibility as to why that phrase is so important here. Come back to the question of, if the story is early, why is it at the end of the Sefer? If the story, Pesach Micha, is an early story, first, second generation Shoftim, days of Moshe's grandson, why is it at the end of the book?
Isn't it the preamble to what's about to come?
It's either a preamble to what's about to come, or
a summary,
or a postscript to what was.
Right, but it's like the Ma'avar.
Right, so it's one or the other. It's either a preamble to what's coming, could be both. And I suspect it is both. But essentially what you're suggesting is that the story is a kind of a isolated paradigm. Here's the book of Shoftim, all of its iterations of its structure and its spirals of the book of the different Shoftim. After they're all done, Shimshon is the last Shofet. Chronologically, we go from Shimshon to Eli and Shmuel. But in the meantime, from a literary perspective, take a break, and add into the text two stories that chronologically are any other period of time. Doesn't matter. Any could have happened early, could have happened in the middle. Doesn't really tell us. But what it is telling us is there's a postscript to this text. There's a conclusion to the story to the book of Shoftim. And the conclusion is Ein Melech b'Yisrael. The conclusion is that this is all happening because there's no Melech. What did they have? What have they had for the last 350 years?
Shofet.
Neither Rabag nor the Radak wants to go this direction, but I think that that's probably the pshat of the pasuk, which is that Melech, in contradistinction to Shofet, meaning it's a conclusion on the history or the period of Sefer Shoftim. The conclusion is all of this happened for a reason. Because Ein Melech b'Yisrael. Which leaves us with the bigger challenge, which is to figure out what it is about the failure of the institution of the Shofet that the Navi was pointing to, which it felt could be resolved had there been a Melech. That's why Suzanne suggested it's a preamble to Sefer Shmuel, because it's really, that's the bridge. If you take the entire book of Shoftim, which is about the leadership of the Shofet, or the institution of the Shofet, and the institution of the Melech, and you ask, okay, which is, if the Shofet fails as a form of leadership, we need to replace it with a Melech. Ein Melech b'Yisrael, therefore, all they had was a Shofet. Therefore, this could happen. So if I read it that way, then, and remember, I have two stories. I have Pesach Micha, which uses that phrase, and I have Pilegesh Begiva, which uses that phrase. If I read it that way, then I really have two stories, or two paradigms, that point to two fundamental issues that need to be addressed by the replacement of the shofet with the melech. Now, don't ask me if that's the case, why in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel is Shmuel so upset about the introduction of the melech. Right, you can't ask that question.
Right?
You can, but I want to answer it. And the reason I want to answer it is because...
we're not there yet.
Right. Because when we get there, we'll have to address that question. But given the fact that it's Shmuel who writes Sefer Shoftim, given the fact that it's Shmuel who authors Sefer Shoftim, stands to reason that if he's concluding at the end of the book of Shoftim that the institution of the Shofet fails because of problem A, Pasamicha, and problem B, Pelegesh Begiva, the solution to both of them somehow is interconnected to the replacement of the Shofet to the Melech, stands to reason that we need to figure out A, what's going on in these two stories, and B, how they bridge us into the world of the Melech. That's part one.
But like Radak and Rabbah, they kind of interchange Melech and Shofet.
The Radak does. The Radak does. The Rabbah does not.
So right, but why are they so quick to, you know, interchange the two? Clearly they're two separate institutions.
So again, it comes back to the question of how you read the text. If you're in the end of Sefer Shoftim and you're reading it straight, you're talking about Shofet, 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 and suddenly post the last Shofet, you read Ein Melech, so the Radak reads the word Melech as a kind of leadership. Ein Melech means there's no leadership. Ein Malchut. Ein Hamanaga. There's no leadership. Call it a Melech, call it a Shofet, irrelevant. We're talking about Ishi Eshar ben Avi Aser, we're talking about anarchy, no leadership. That's how the Radak reads it. It's not a precise what we would refer to as Melech in Sefer Shmuel. That's not the language being used here, says the Radak. Rabag wasn't satisfied with that, so he says, no, we're talking about specifically a Melech. Who's the Melech who we're talking about? Yehoshua. Because, again, they're also arguing about when the story is taking place. Is it between Yehoshua and the first Shofet? Or is it post the last Shofet before Eli? What I'm suggesting is a kasav ashlishi, if you will, a third approach, which is not my own chiddush, but I think it's pretty compelling. And the third approach is that it's both literally in melech and and an early story. In other words, we don't know the time frame. We don't need to know the time frame. It's irrelevant. This story could be taking place at any point in this sefer per se. It's really just it's indicative of the entire era. It's indicative of the failure of the institution of the Shofet. So it's a different way, three different ways to read that phrase. Okay.
Well, the Book of Kings is not exactly an inspirational story of government.
Is that Hashem? We have a long way to go before we get to this Book of Malach.
3 years.
Oh, I'm if it took us 3 years to do Shoftim, and that's only 21 chapters, Shmuel is double that. We'll get there eventually. All right, let's go back to the other half of this phrase. The other half of the phrase is Ishi Yeshar Ben Avyasa. Based on what I'm suggesting, which is that the word Melech is not just a phrase for anarchy, but the fact that there's a failure of an institution of leadership called the Shofet, and therefore the need to replace it with a Melech, begs the next question, which is, so what does the phrase Ishi Yeshar Ben Avyasa mean? What I'm suggesting is that the phrase means that we're not in an anarchy, leaderless society. We have leaders. We have Shoftim. Right? According to Radak, we have no leaders, so I understand what the phrase Yishir Shar Ben Avyasa means. According to the Rabag, I'm missing Yehoshua, so nobody's powerful enough to stop this. But according to what I'm suggesting, which is that the word Melech here is simply an indictment of the leadership of the Shofet, so nonetheless, you had a Shofet, you had Shoftim for 300 plus years. You had Otniel Ben Knaz. Removed idolatry to stop the idolatry for a period of 40 years. You had Eben Gera, you had a Gidon. you had other leaders throughout the period of time. So what does the phrase Ishe Yeshar Benav Yaseh mean in this context? What I would suggest is that the phrase itself is not a general statement of anarchy or free-for-all, if you will, or hefker, but I think it's a phrase that has a very specific meaning in the world of Tanakh. It's not a common phrase. The phrase Ish Hayashar Be'enav appears a handful of times in Tanakh, once in the context of Yasita Yashar Be'enei Hashem, which is the opposite of Ish Hayashar Be'enav Yaseh, once in Sefer Mishlei, but its most powerful phrase source is in Dvarim Perek Yud Bet. So that's where I want to go today. Let's take a look at Dvarim Perek Yud Bet.
It depends what pasuk. It may be the page before.
The page after.
What pasuk are we talking about?
We're going to look at it from the beginning of the parak.
Okay, so 224 though.
224.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, 226.
Wait, you're the Olive? Oh, I'm sorry, you're the 226 then. Sorry, I thought it was the Olive. 226.
Right. The phrase itself, we'll zero in on the phrase and then we'll go back to the beginning of the parak. The phrase itself appears in Pasuk Chet, verse 8. Lo ta'asun kechol asher anachnu osim po hayom, ish kol hayashar be'inav. You shall not do that which we do today here, every man what is right in their own eyes. Ish hayashar be'inav. Now this is Rashi. This is Moshe Rabbeinu in Sefer Dvarim. So right away we have a problem. Before I even understand this phrase, I have a problem with this phrase, which is Moshe speaking to Bnei Yisrael saying, "You shall not do that which we do today." Lo tasun gochol asher anachnu osim po hayom, ish yeshar beinav. Each man what is right in their own eyes. Same phrase. So right away, what does this tell me? Before I understand anything about context, other than the fact that this is Moshe Rabbeinu speaking to them in year 40 of the sojourn in the desert. How have we understood the phrase till now?
Every person does the unthing.
That's what it translates at. How have we understood it?
Every man for himself.
Free fall, hefker.
Right? There's absolutely no rhyme or reason, no law, lawlessness. Does that fit? Who's speaking?
Moshe.
Moshe said, right? This is Dvarim, this is Sefer Dvarim. Who's speaking?
Moshe.
Year 40. Put in context, does the phrase fit? Prepared to describe the world of Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar under Moshe's leadership as free fall, hefker, lawlessness.
Maybe he's talking about the future, what's
going to
happen.
He says, po, osim po hayom. Mm-hmm. It's very specific. Right?
Yeah.
That's exactly the problem. Mm-hmm. Very difficult to describe the world of Moshe Rabbeinu as lawless, free fall, every man for himself, complete anarchy.
That's just the way it's always been, always will be.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't fit the phrase Lo Ishka Yashar Be'enav Yaseh.
Nothing's new.
The world of Moshe Rabbeinu cannot be described as such. So that, in and of itself, tells me that this phrase is much more specific, much more focused than just a description of lawlessness. What it means now requires us to understand this pasuk in context. So let's go back to the beginning of the parak.
I didn't say one thing.
That
Excuse sentence me? Just comes right after they talk about the three pilgrimages.
We're going to see that in a second. Correct. Okay. Let's go back to the beginning of the parak. אלה החוקים והמשפטים אשר תשמרון לעשות בארץ אשר נתן השם אלוקי אבותיך לך לרשתה. These are the laws, the statutes which God has given you to command, to observe in the land of Israel. כל הימים אשר אתם חיים על האדמה. All the years that you will live on this land. Step 1. עבד תעבדון את כל המקומות אשר עבדו שם הגויים. First mandate to destroy, remove, obliterate all of the places where the indigenous Canaanite population worship their gods, worshiped idols. The land, the nations asher atem yorshim otam et Elohim, nations whose land you will live in, that you are going to move into, and their deities, their idols. This is a land filled with idols. You're going to live in this land, the first thing you need to do is get rid of all of these idols. And where do they worship these idols? They worship these idols al heharim aramim, on the tops of mountains, v'ala gva'ot, and in the valleys, v'tachat kol etz ra'anan, and under every tree. Every hilltop was a place of avodah zarah. Every tree, because it was a potential asherah. They worship the foundation of pagan idolatry is that it is not place centric, but focuses on various powers and authorities and deities for every type of various aspect of life. But there is no central location, there is no central place for worship. Where do they worship their gods?
Wherever they are.
Anywhere. Depending on where the god was, depending what the god was, but essentially anywhere. Therefore, as you come into the land of Israel, you're going to find yourself in a place where every hill could potentially have an altar on it to some deity. V'nitatzem et mizbechotam v'shibartem at matzevotam v'asherahem tisufum be'esh v'psilei Elohim tikadayun. Their mizbeach, their matzeva, their altars, their monuments, their trees that they worship, the asherah, their psalim, their idols, graven images, all of these have to be cut down, destroyed, burnt, whatever methodology is appropriate. V'ibadetem et shemam min ha-makom ahu, to remove their name and reference and remembrance from this place. I used the phrase when we studied Yehoshua, the mandate in the land of Israel was to create an idolatry-free zone in the land of Israel. No museums of natural history to the world of idolatry. Not allowed. Lo tasun ken la'Hashem Elokechem. That which you may not do with regards to God. What are you not allowed to do with regards to how you worship or serve God?
Places all over the land.
Right, right. So there's two levels to this pasuk. There's the pshat and there's the halachic drash. The pshat is that we're talking about building altars or temples all over any place you want. The halachic drash is that it's talking about the erasing or the breaking of the altars and the smashing of the burning of the trees or the religious items that they use for their pagan idolatry. You're not allowed to do so with regards to God. So Chazal darshan this pasuk as the source for the prohibition of erasing God's name. Mechikat Hashem. Similar idea. But in the context of this parak, what we're talking about is the idea that what characterized paganism was the fact that you could worship gods anywhere you wanted, because there are multiple gods, therefore there are multiple
places
to worship them. The notion of one place is irrelevant to the language of paganism. But when it comes to worshiping and serving Hashem, where you're talking about one deity, we're talking about one God, lo tasun ken la'Hashem Elokecha. Rather, כי אם על המקום שיבחר השם אלוקיכם מכל שבטיכם לשום את שמו שם. One place that God will choose to place his name there. And that place which God will choose to place his name there, לשכנו תדבשו ובאת שמה. To that place, to his שכינה, to his presence, you will seek, and there you will come. All of your offerings, all of your burnt offerings, all of your korbanot, all of your tithes, all of your gifts, everything that you do in the context of avoda to Hashem, nidvechem, nidvotechem, your gift offerings and your oath offerings and your bechorot bekarchem v'tzonchem and your firstborn offerings, everything that is part of the rituals of Jewish life must be brought there. Va'achaltem sham. All of these offerings are eaten there. Lifnei Hashem Elokechem. Before God. In the presence of the Mikdash. Usmachtem b'chol mishlach yadchem atem uvatechem asher b'lachecha Hashem Elokecha. There you shall rejoice before God. The whole message of this parak essentially boils down to one idea, which is
only
one place.
And one God.
The foundation of monotheism and how it differs from paganism is that if you're talking about one God, it stands to reason that there is only one place to worship or serve this one God. One location. God will choose it. Makom she'yivchar Hashem. One mishkan. One mikdash. No allowance for any alternative offerings, alternative mizbeachs or mizbechot, alternative high places, or however you want to do it, that's all beyond the pale. We talked about this, I don't know if we discussed this when we did Yehoshua, the beginning of Yehoshua actually, but to some extent, it's really the mystery or the theological challenge that Bnei Yisrael faced after the Churban. We talked about it once before, right? The theological crisis after the Churban was that for 1,000 years they had lived with the sense that there really is only one place to worship, one God. That's what foundation of monotheism is. And it took the Navi, it took Yechezkel to be able to create for them a framework by which they could allow for the notion of a Beit Tefillah or a house of Tefillah outside of the context of the Mikdash. In the institution of the synagogue. But in the world of Tanakh, it certainly does not exist. In the world of Tanakh, there's only one place to worship God, because anything else smells of Avodah Zarah. Then we come to our phrase. Lo ta'asun kein, lo ta'asun k'chol asher anachnu asim po hayom. What is Moshe saying to them? You can't do that which we do today. That which is commonplace here, even in the desert. Ish kolei yashar be'enav. Each one doing what is right in their own eyes. I'll come back to the phrase in a moment. Because this has been allowed here and now for reasons which are, ki lo vatem ad ata lemenucha ve'lenachala asher Hashem elokecha neten lach. This was an allowance only because we haven't yet arrived at the place, the menucha, the nachala, the inheritance, which God has given you. However, avartem et ha-yarden, once you cross over to the Yarden, v'yishavtem ba'aretz asher Hashem elokechem menchil etchem, and you will settle in a land that God has given you, or will give you, v'niach lechem Hashem mikol levechem misaviv, and God will give you respite from all your enemies, v'yishavtem betach, you'll dwell in security, then, amakom asher, ayah, amakom asher yivchar Hashem elokechem bo l'sheken shmo sham, then there will be one place that God will choose. Shama taviu kol asher anachim etzave etchem. There you will bring all that God commands you. Olatechem v'zivchechem, masutechem, tumat yatchem, v'chom yivchar nidvechem, all of these various offerings that we talked about before. There, usmachtem lifnei Hashem elokechem, you will rejoice before God. You and the Levi and the everybody in the land. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Hishamer lecha. Guard yourself. You may not bring your offerings any place you wish. But only to that place that God will choose from amongst your tribes. There you may bring your ola, your burnt offerings to Hashem. There you will do that which I command you. Now listen to the next phrase. Rak bechol avat nafshecha tizbach ve'achalta basar kivirkat Hashem elkecha shenatan lecha bechol shareicha. But if and only according to the desire of your heart you wish to eat bechol avat nafshecha, you will slaughter and eat meat according to the success that God will give you. You may eat that which is that which you are permissible to eat. You may not eat the blood. You must spill the blood on the land, on the ground. You may not eat the tithes in your field, in your etc. You know, it's that which is masa, pasuk dayin, lo tuchal le'achol b'sharecha masad gancha, but in your gates, you may not eat the tithes, and you may not eat the b'chor, you may not eat the firstborns, and you may not eat the oaths and the various offerings that you bring to Hashem. That has to be brought, kim lifnei Hashem elokecha tochalenu, that can only be brought lifnei Hashem. V'makom asher yivchar Hashem elokecha lebo, in that place that God will choose. From amongst the tribes. You, your sons, your daughters, your servants, your maidservants, the Levi, everybody in your land. Take a look at the beginning, Pasuk Chaf. Ki yarchiv Hashem elkecha et gvulcha, when God will expand your boundaries, expand your borders. Now you're too far away. You're no longer living in the camp of Gilgal. You're no longer living in the Midbar, in the environs of the walking distance of the Mishkan. V'amarta ochla basar, and then you say, well, wait a second, I want to have meat. I can't bring a korban to the Beit HaMikdash every time I want to have a fleishich dinner. Therefore, kitave nafshecha l'achol basar, you desire, you want, you crave, you want to be able to have meat. So what do you do? B'chol avat nafshecha tochal basar, you want to eat meat according to your heart's desire. However, because the place that God will choose to place your name there is too far from you. And therefore you can't go bring a korban every time you want to have dinner. So what do? So you take your animals that God has given you, God has blessed you with, slaughter them according to the laws that I have shared with you, the source of the mitzvah of Shechita. V'chata b'sharecha, and eat them in your gates. Eat them however you want. B'cholavat nafshecha, according to your heart's desire. You must only, however, you have to eat them according to the laws that I have given you. Hatameh v'ato yachdav, you're allowed to eat them in a state of tumah. It's not like the Beit HaMikdash, which can only be eaten in Tara. However, you may not eat the blood. You have to spill the blood into the ground. You have to kasher the animals, etc. And the rest of the procedures revolve in regards to basar, chulim, non-sanctified meat. Summarize. Essentially, this parak identifies two issues. Number one, fundamental difference between Judaism and between the Torah and the world of paganism is that in a monotheistic context, there can only be one place for serving God. For avoda, which means korban. Korban means mikdash. The Mikdash, one place. Makom Hashem Charashem, the place that God will choose from amongst the tribes. He will designate one location. To that one location. Call it a Mishkan, call it a Mikdash, call it what you will, but to that one location, you will bring your Korbanot. Not like we do here today. Lo kechol asher nachnu osim po hayom, ish yashar b'nav yaseh, each one doing their own thing. Meaning, what was allowed in the Midbar that would no longer be allowed in the land of Israel?
The Mishkan traveled with them.
Besides the fact that the Mishkan traveled, and that is true, and therefore, because the Mishkan traveled, in a sense, the place of the Mishkan moved from mountain to mountain, from hill to hill, from valley to valley. You come to the land of Israel, it's going to end up in a specific place, in a specific home, and you are going to come to it, rather than it traveling around. There's also an assumption that that which the Torah then goes on to prohibit was allowed in the desert. Namely, they could also bring bamot. What was a bama? Bama was a kind of private altar. Bama was a private altar. The word bama means private altars. A person could bring, wanted to bring a korban, so instead of having to come to the Beit HaMikdash, they wanted to have a fleishach dinner, wanted to have a barbecue, so they would make an offering to Hashem, build themselves a little altar, bring it on a bama, slaughter the animal, bring it as a korban, half the animal goes on the mizbech, the other half you can eat. And that's essentially what the world of the bamot were. They were self-appointed backyard mizbeachs. That's certainly a hangover, if you will, from the world of paganism. So we, even though we had a mishkan, it seems to be that there was an allowance for the world of bamot during that period of the midbar. Says Moshe, come into the land of Israel, that stops. Everybody, what they want to do in their own eyes. In the world of Israel, there's two limitations. Limitation number one, no more bamot. Number two,
one location.
One permanent location. Mishkan's not going to start moving around like it did in the Midbar. It's not going to go from camp to camp. It's going to come to what the Torah calls Minucha v'nachala, a rest, a place, a permanence. The Minucha referring to the Mishkan, Chazal Darshan is referring to the Mishkan in Shiloh, which stood for 369 years. The Nachla referring to Yerushalayim, where the Mikdash stood for 410 years. But it'll be a permanent location. You may not bring Korbanot outside of the Mikdash. Now, at the moment you create that limitation, you also create a problem that has to be addressed, resolved, which is
getting there.
So it's one thing if you want to get there for Shalosh Regalim, you want to get there for Yontif, it's okay. It's half the problem. But what if you want to have dinner? And you want to have fleishchs for dinner? Now we assume, because we live in a post, in a world of Torah, meaning post the giving of all the laws, we assume that there's a fundamental difference between eating meat and bringing a korban. But in the world of Chumash, in the Midbar, that wasn't the case. In the Midbar, if you wanted to eat meat, there was only one way to eat meat. And that was to bring a korban shlamim.
It's supposed to be vegan, okay. Come on.
Not because
that.
Of the conclusion.
She couldn't resist that.
I'll buy that you couldn't resist that. The
She right?
That's what I said. I'll buy that. You
Nobody
couldn't resist
else came
up. She's been looking at me the whole discussion. That's I mean, it was just a matter of time before that was going to come out. But that's precisely what the Torah then does in the same perek, in the same breath. So okay, but now now Hashem is bringing you into a land, into a country, north to south. It's a big country, relatively speaking, to the Midbar.
It's too far,
right? You can't go to the Mikdash or to the Mishkan every time you want to have dinner. So the Torah creates an allowance for the eating of meat outside of the Mikdash. Chulin. That you can shech, that you can slaughter, that you can prepare. There are certain rules, regulations about how. Now it's time to introduce those rules and regulations. Shchita and kashering and the blood, all of that's required because we're now dealing with what we didn't have in Sefer Vayikra. In all of Sefer Vayikra, there is no reference whatsoever to eating meat outside of the context of a korban. So when you live in the little bubble of the Mishkan and the Mishkan travels with you, so you want to have meat, you take a korban shlam and you bring it to the Mishkan, part of it goes to the Mizbech and you have the rest for dinner. But you're living in Dan, or in the Naphtali, or in Asher, and the Mishkan's in Shiloh. So now you have to have an allowance for meat. This is so far clear? Now let's look at the phraseology. The Mishkan is described as Mishkan / Mikdash is described as Right? Menucha nachala. But the key phrase in this parak, and the key phrase that will stay with us for the rest of Sefer Devarim, Makom, Asher Yivchar, Hashem, the Shaken Shmo Hashem. What defines this place, characteristic of this place, is that it is Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem. And in this place, Asher Yivchar Hashem, all of your korbanot, essentially anything related to kachim,
takes place there.
Must take place there and can only take place there. If you take korban, kachim, sacrificial meat, sacrificial any kind of avoda, and you put it anywhere else, I'll call har gavoa tachat kol etz ra'anan. You put it anywhere else, what are you guilty of?
Avodah
Zarah. Referred to in this parak as a mizbeach outside of the context of this makom asher yivchar Hashem is referred to in this parak as
Yashar
Be'enav. Asher Yashar Be'enav. Why is korban on a mizbeach outside of the mikdash called Asher Yashar Be'enav? Because it's in contradistinction to Mizbeach in the Beit HaMikdash is Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem. It's God's Bechira in contradistinction to
man's
desire. Even Basar Chulin, even meat that is not Kodshim, which can be eaten outside of the Mikdash, which can be eaten outside of the Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem, is described as what?
What's basachul?
This parak is talking about two different kinds of eating meat. Korbanot, olotechem, zivchechem, nidvachem, nidvotechem, which can only be eaten by makom asher yivchar Hashem. And then, starting with pasuk chaf, there's another agenda, which is what happens when you want to eat meat that's outside of the mikdash.
When you're too far away.
You're too far away from the mikdash.
So you're allowed.
That's what we call chulin, right? Non-sacrificial meat. All of our meat today is chulin, because it's chol. Comes the word chol, in contradistinction to kodship. Non-sacrificial meat. What does the Torah call it? Rak b'chol avat nafshecha tochal basar. You may eat meat according to your avat nafshecha, desire of your heart, referred to in the halacha as basar ta'ava.
When the word ta'ava is not such a, it's not positive.
I need to go back.
No, but that, I mean, isn't the connotation of ta'ava not positive?
It can be used not in a non-positive context, but essentially it means that if you desire something, so here's a context which the Torah allows it, and here's a context which the Torah does not allow it. So if you want to bring, if you lived in the Midbar, then you weren't allowed to eat meat at your leisure. Meat to your heart's content. Any meat. Over or under any meat. You're living in the land of Israel. Now you can't live in, you can't bring a korban every time you want to have dinner. You want to have dinner. The phrase here is not because it's a taiva, like in the context of the Musar taiva. The phrase here is in contradistinction to. It's a contrast between God's choice and man's
needs.
Desires.
Is it like a bidyavad?
No? You're not going to win this one. You might as well just give this up. That's not the issue. But what is clear is that the phraseology of this whole
conversation revolves around this contrast that Korban, Kodshim, outside of the Mikdash-centered world, is referred to as Ashi Yashar Be'enav. Kodshim, that is in accordance with the laws of the Torah, is only B'makom Asher Yivchar Hashem. Is this clear? So now I come to the story of Pesach Micha. And what do we have in the story of Pesach Micha? It's not all mixed up at all. What do we have in the story of Pesach Micha?
Idol worship?
The opposite.
Idol worshiping. Idol worshiping. They're going to Micha's. And what's the remarkable part of Micha's world of this Pesach? Is what are they doing with this Pesach?
I have no idea.
Yes, we do. What are they doing this Perek? Every time the whole story is about. He doesn't just build a pesel and an altar. He builds a hotel. He builds a bed and breakfast. He builds a place where people come and they sleep and they eat. It's an entire operation over there. There is clearly a mizbeach and pesel and right, there is clearly a avodah zara going on, and this avodah zara is absolutely not in the place Asher Yivchar Hashem. The whole story sets up a contrast between the Pesel of Micha and the Mishkan of
Sheila.
And the Mishkan in Sheila.
That's all messed up.
That's all messed up. If that's what you meant by all messed up, then you're correct. I thought you meant the phrase. The phrase is very specific. I'll come back to the Melach Bezat Hashem next week. But the Ish Yeshab Be'nav Yasen now in this context is a phrase that's taken right out of Chumash. Avodah Zarah, by its very definition, Kodshim outside of the Mikdash, outside of the Mishkan, is, by definition, Ish Yeshab Be'nav. There's nobody says the Vedak or Bag to stop the Avodah Zarah. How a Melech stops the Avodah Zarah, we shall continue in our discussion next week. But there's no Melech, and therefore the Avodah Zarah is rampant. What do we call Avodah Zarah? What do we call Kodshim outside of the Mikdash? What do we call what we see in the world of Pesach Micha? We call it Yishe Yeshab Beinah. In contradistinction to the Mikdash, which is the Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem. That's, I think, the phrase that's being set up for us and how it fits into the world of Micha's idolatry. So what we will do next week, Bezrat Hashem, is look at Malchus. How does a Melech resolve or help in this regard? Assuming we finish that and a discussion of Shiloh, then we are ready the week following to start our study of Pelegesh Begiva.
But Sheva's in
Shiloh
today. They're on the
TV. Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
That's so funny.
I'll have him change the team.
But he said something.